In today's episode, we're going to take the plunge and dive into the data. Recently, we talked about MOOCs and how they're hitting the headlines in education. Well, next to them, learning analytics is another of the more fashionable areas of educational research. Big data is all the rage, and analytics are claimed as the solution to retention, satisfaction, and pretty much every other student problem around. But is it all true, or is it hype? Well, let's find out. Learning analytics have grown out of the increasing use of technology in education. We're working with VLEs, social media, and Web2 tech, and every one of them gives us access to stats and data around how students are accessing the material. Particularly in the first year, our own virtual learning environments are logging every student action relating to online learning materials. And as more and more courses become heavily blended, this is starting to give us a really full picture of how students are progressing through their course. If we can surface this data and uncover the trends, surely we can start to experiment with different approaches, evaluate our materials and start to predict issues well in advance. One report on the area which gives a really in-depth analysis is from the US Department of Education, titled Enhancing Teaching and Learning Through Educational Data Mining and Learning Analytics. They never go for easy topic names on these, do they? It covers a range of ways in which analytics are used and summarises probably the most obvious use, that is, user modelling. So this is where we use analytics to see what a student has done and predict what they will do in future from that. This kind of modelling should let us spot trouble up the road and give the student a nudge in an attempt to avoid it. There are a range of more in-depth ways analytics can be used, though, beyond simple access data. The Society for Learning Analytics Research, or SOLAR as they're known, stated in their society report a few more unique ways in which analytics could be used. Discourse analytics is one. This is where algorithms can analyse discussion postings within a course and tell the difference between shallow social writing and deep critical thinking. This could really help to evaluate the success of a social task or an assessment. Another is mood analysis, where social updates are monitored and turned into a measure of student emotions. Mood has been closely linked to learning achievement, so if a student is found to be on a bad trajectory, this can be spotted and dealt with. To get a much more in-depth picture of the world of learning analytics, I thought I'd bring in an expert to help. His name is Adam Cooper, and since he'll know it best, I'll let him introduce himself.
Okay, so I'm Adam Cooper. I'm one of the directors of CETIS, which is the Centre for Educational Technology and Interoperability Standards. And pretty much our name is, tells you what we do. We've spent quite a long time particularly working around data movements in universities in particular and trying to get interoperability and develop standards around that area, but also taking kind of a balanced view about education technology innovation. And we've been involved in things like personal learning environments over the years. Most recently, we've got involved with a European project called the Learning Analytics Community Exchange, which was partially a consequence of our earlier work on learning analytics working with the JISC.
So that's where Adam's coming from. Now, let's move on to the first question, which might seem a bit obvious. What's learning analytics all about? Here, Adam gives us a quick primer on what it is and how it can be used.
Well, I think there's a number of views here. I'm quite keen on the idea that learning analytics, just focus on analytics first, that analytics is about using data to capture something that you can do something about. And there's a phrase bandied around quite a lot about actionable insights. And I think this is to me, an important facet of the analytics part of learning analytics. It's about things that are meaningful, that you can look at and you can do something about, and also that you should do something about. So we have some idea about things like statistical confidence there. So you look at something, you don't just go, that's a pretty graph, or oh, data. Or you don't just look at it and say that that's telling me about the past, but it tells you something that you're able to do something about in the future. So I think is something about what makes it a little bit distinctive from just talking about data. It's that we're able to do something about it. And this can involve a variety of techniques. Lots of traditional statistics is involved, but also some slightly more recent techniques, largely from computer science around machine learning, which is essentially looking at big volumes of data and trying to find patterns that people can't see. And that might be patterns in terms of correlations, might be said patterns in terms of clustering of similarity. One of the challenges in, you know, actually moving forward is to work out exactly what data we really want to have in our hands to be able to answer useful questions. On the whole, people tend to look at what they already have, and this is kind of where we are now. That so what do people already have now? They have information in the student record system about the student's academic history and their demographics. Naturally, we have quite a lot of data coming out of virtual learning environments, although, of course, that's only a small part of the overall learning experience. I think also we have things like end-of-module surveys, and they can actually be potentially useful because they're so widely spread in practical use.
Adam mentions quite a few sources there, many of which are very qualitative, looking at the student experience, as he mentions. He also hinted at the data coming out of VLEs, and he is right that that's a small part of the learning experience, but it also does yield some really interesting results. And that's where we're getting much more data around engagement trends, around how students are interacting with the course, and where we can get a lot of detail around which parts of our courses are being used, which parts aren't, and where we can maybe draw a lot more insight. Next, I thought it was worth asking about concerns. One obvious area is the fear of a slightly Big Brother approach where everyone's performance, everyone's teaching is monitored. Where did Adam stand on that?
I think we've not really seen that yet. I think it's a big worry. It's certainly, if I was investing very much money in taking learning analytics on as an institutional matter, we should be very cautious about the risk of backlash. We've seen it in other areas. I think many people have heard of In Bloom, which was an initiative in the United States, initially funded, I think, with Gates Foundation money. And this was adopted by a number of states, and they were collecting huge amounts of data from school children in the US. And there was apparently no security breach of any kind and no improper use of the data, but there was a lack of trust developed, and then there were a series of decisions in the states not to allow the data to be collected and held, and essentially the whole thing imploded millions of dollars down the line. So even in circumstances where you say, you know, they weren't selling the data to third parties, it wasn't leaked, it was purely a matter of trust. So I think we do need to be very cautious about that and not just assume that what seems to be quite a cavalier approach that young people have towards their data and social media will necessarily transfer to an educational context. Will there be concerns about universities and their teachers using data against them somehow, using data to catch them out? So I think we need to be very mindful of how we might approach learning analytics and really to be very, very clear that it is about helping students to make progress and not testing them and excluding them or somehow catching them out. I think it's incredibly difficult actually to do this in a very satisfactory way, but I think we have to move towards the idea that it's a journey. You know, we will be transparent about what we're collecting, who uses it for what purposes. And then the kind of the second layer into that is to think about, okay, so how well have we shown that what we're doing with it is actually defensible?
Okay, so we've covered the concerns and given a bit of intro. Let's have a look now at the pros and cons. What is learning analytics good at? Here's Adam on the strengths of learning analytics.
One of the things that they're potentially quite useful for is to help to challenge and test some of our assumptions. I think at all levels, we make assumptions about what goes on in teaching and learning contexts, how our students are using virtual learning environments, about the relationship between prior knowledge and success, different kinds of entry characteristics of students, what kind of support we should give them, the kind of assessment we do and its validity, whether we're assessing too much or not enough in the right kind of ways. So I think analytics gives us a lens on looking at some of these and not necessarily giving us the answers, because I think often there's a lot of uncertainties, a lot of maybe some contested ideas even around here, but it helps us to look at some and say, well, how might things be comparing? And so that's a little bit of a kind of a non-answer in a sense. I think another non-answer, but it's to say, well, what's it good for? It's good for situations where you know what the data means, and you have some sense that the data you've collected gives a some sense of complete view of what's going on, because you know typically we're not going to have all of the data we'd want. It's only going to be what we can capture. There's a lot of things go on which are simply uncaptured. But also, even when we do capture things, we've got an issue about data quantity and quality. So I think we need to this is be very careful and say, well, you know, where do we think we know what the data means to understand its significance? And there are some simple examples you can give where it's easy to make assumptions that are actually not true. And the further away you are from where the data was created, the more likely you are to make incorrect assumptions.
So it's definitely not just the numbers. You've got to do a bit of interpretation as well then.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's been running for a few years now, the Pittsburgh Science of Learning Data Shop, they've collected sort of predictive intelligent tutoring systems. And when they're collecting this, they're always quite keen to make sure that you can capture something about the user interface that was actually being used at the time, so you really can get an idea about interpretation in terms of exactly what was clicked on and how things were working from the user's point of view.
So the numbers alone don't tell the whole story. I thought it'd be useful to have a chat with Adam about some case studies, about some examples of how learning analytics are being used out there in the real world. And this first case study gives a good example of how human interpretation interaction has to be used alongside the numbers to make sure that analytics are used effectively.
There's one, it was a project, and then it's become available as a product now from Purdue University called Signals. And this, I think, was one of the early well-known examples of using learning analytics going back at least 3 years now. And the idea of Signals really was to try and identify students who were at risk and to be able to make some potentially lightweight engagement with the student to try and get them back on track. And they collected data over quite a few years and it seemed to show that this signal system was effective at improving the final outcomes and also retention. Now, I think there's a couple of things which are interesting to me about signals. One is in terms of how it was done. They purposefully did things like that. It wasn't purely automated, that there was a simple traffic light system, which was kind of, you know, at risk, kind of in between amber and green, everything's okay. But it wasn't so much as just pushed out. These were always recommendations of the system to the academic staff. And then they were the one who decided, you know, what to do about it, where to send a message to the student. So they were very much involved in that process from a practical point of view, but also in terms of the design of the system. It was, I think, quite a collaborative and participative process. And I think that's useful, you know, for a variety of reasons. One is it didn't make the academic staff think that they were being sidelined. It was practically useful in that actually it's quite complex to decide whether or not something needs to be done about what might be a problem, or whether it's just that, well, I know they were off last week, that their mother was in hospital or whatever. Then don't send an inappropriate email telling the student to pull their finger out. So, from that point of view, it seemed to be a good match to what goes on in practice rather than a techno solution. So the second point I think is interesting with the Purdue Signals is that there was a bit of a hoo-ha maybe a year ago now when someone later along came and looked at the data, which seemed to show, I think it was, you know, two courses which had signals was kind of the magic number for success. And they looked at the statistics and said, well, actually, there's some kind of inevitability about this. You've not really shown that it works. And there was quite a lot of hoo-ha about this. And I think this goes back to our comments earlier about transparency and the ability for other people to really test the claims of effectiveness. Now, as far as I know, this is still one of those kind of things that was unresolved. It was a bit of an argument But you know, the data hasn't been made available for the people to look at and investigate. Now, I actually think that, in a sense, whether or not it led to statistically significant increases in retention or achievement is only part of the story. I think we need to also look about how signals as a system fits within the kind of the working environment. Are some of the positive things a little bit softer than that in terms of workload on staff, in terms of student satisfaction? In terms of, even if the grades were no higher, was there something qualitatively richer about the student's engagement? And so one of the reasons I think initially I said I was a bit cautious about good examples was that I think it's actually quite challenging to have really strong, robust evidence which says, you know, here we've proven statistically that doing this will improve X, Y, and Z. And in fact, one of the things we've been doing in the LACE project is trying to gather an evidence base together. And there isn't a huge amount of really robust evidence, the kind of evidence you'd want if you were going to put a drug on the market, for example. But I think what we can see is more qualitative how learning analytics fits in into real world life, even if we can't really nail down outcome changes.
What I took from that was the idea of satisfaction levels rather than pure numerical achievement. It may be that we can raise pass marks or attendance using analytics, but as Adam says, that's a really difficult thing to measure in a robust way. Can we use analytics then to indicate current or impending problems so that we can then do something about them? Does that mean in the end students and staff are more happy, more satisfied within their course? It might not translate directly to higher marks or to better retention, but even if it doesn't, that's still a pretty good result and something that can only be measured in a qualitative way. Okay, let's move on to Adam's second example, which goes through how the Open University supports staff in getting into learning analytics using a unique kind of support.
The other example I'd like to call out is the Open University UK doing. They have quite a lot of activity in learning analytics in several departments in the university, but one of the initiatives that works across the university is the idea of data wranglers. And these are people who work with folks in the academic departments to really try and understand the data and what it's telling them about their students. And I think this is it takes the idea away from being, you know, this is something that the IT systems give us, to being much more of a kind of a human process. So they have their data collection, they have some team of statisticians there, but they also have these data wranglers that are able to wrangle the data, you know, come to grips with that they have some analytical knowledge and expertise. They're not necessarily statisticians, but they understand the teaching learning process and they're able to engage with academic staff to understand what the data means. I think that's a kind of a key part of the whole equation is being able to understand it and understand the nuances, and having someone there you can have a conversation with can help us really to look at the data and to build it into a kind of continuous improvement process, into an action research kind of process maybe.
I love the name there, data wranglers. And I think something as simple as that can actually help to engage staff with something that's perceived as possibly a bit difficult to do, a bit dry. So yeah, I think that's a great approach by the Open University there. That's pretty much our time up here this week, but I just want to leave you with one thought. The message I kept hearing from Adam throughout is that analytics isn't all about the data. The data is the starting point, but really that's just statistics and surveys. It turns into learning analytics when you interpret it, when you decide what you're going to do with it, and importantly, when you have a purpose to that analysis and an aim for some kind of change based on the results. It's really a way of testing assumptions and helping you to improve everything you do in your teaching based on that. Thanks for listening, folks. I hope you got a lot out of today's podcast. Remember, it'd be great to hear from you. Let us know what you think. You can drop a comment on the podcast page at thepodcasthost.com/SBOSE. Please do let us know what you think, and we'll see you on the next episode.